This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will visit with Dr. Jeffrey Keller, Director of the Institute for Dementia Research and Prevention at Pennington Biomedical Research Center here in Baton Rouge, the world-renowned facility on Perkins Road. We will talk with him about Alzheimer's, Louisiana, unfortunately, right at the top of the list in the rate of Alzheimer's. And Johnny Palazzotto, the man about town who knows the music scene about as well as anybody in North America. He's here to discuss music developments in our community, including the annual Slim Harpo Awards. We'll remember Richie Havens as well, who died this week at 72. And Marcus Cox, he's a professor at the Citadel, a graduate of Southern University. His book is Segregated Soldiers, Military Training at Historically Black Colleges in the Jim Crow South. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Thank you for joining us today. We start with Dr. Jeffrey Keller, the Institute for Dementia Research and Prevention at Pennington Biomedical Research Center right here in our community. Dr. Keller, who's been at Pennington for 5 years, is on the cutting edge of research on Alzheimer's and dementia. And, of course, there are clinical trials that are ongoing at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center. How do the trials work, Doc? Good to see you.
Thank you, Jim. The way that the trials work are that we have a variety of people who come to us directly with active Alzheimer's disease or mild cognitive impairment. We have a variety of trials for those people to enroll in and to try to stop the progression of the disease, find new medications. There are currently no effective medications for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease, and we can talk about that.
But there are I know there are medicines that are prescribed, but you're saying they're really not.
Yeah, it's
doing
one of
the job.
Yeah, it's one of those really hot and important areas right now. Consumer Reports last month came out actually and said that they did not recommend these medications, and largely it's because a lot of people don't get benefit from them. It's a subset of people that do, and they do have some side effects. It's not to say that it's not important for those people to consult with their physician and look at this closely, but clearly there's a gap in a need for effective medications for the treatment.
297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation. This is a story close to all of us. We, I'm sure, have known someone in our circle of friends, maybe a close family member who has had dementia or Alzheimer's. Dr. Jeffrey Keller at Pennington is studying this quite closely, and Pennington is regarded as one of the places where some of the most productive and insightful research is ongoing on this subject. 877-217-5757, wherever you are outside the community, and Inkstershow at WRKF.org works when you're trying to reach us via email. First of all, there is a distinction between dementia and Alzheimer's.
Right. That's one of the most common questions that I get. Dementia is a broad category of things. It's a decline in cognitive status from a previous state, and it can be caused by a variety of problems. And Alzheimer's is a much more specific state and generally associated with a memory impairment that's significant enough to affect work, social life. Happens in the absence of other neurological abnormalities. So these people, or at least early on, don't have balance problems, epilepsy, or movement of limb issues. It's progressive and sort of a slow, steady progression, not associated with sudden drops in function. Can't be associated with any sort of acute onset. And we also rule out things like B12 deficiency, thyroid deficiency. And what happens is when someone comes into their physician or research study like ours, these things are all assessed, and a picture emerges of someone who is more of an Alzheimer's type dementia. So it's a subset. Mm-hmm.
Generally, when someone is diagnosed with this, how quickly is the progression?
And that's a very interesting question. Nationwide, the people have the disease for 7 to 10 years. It is a very long, insidious disease at the current state of things. And but here in Louisiana, we also see a lot of people who tend to not really last that long. It seems to progress a lot faster in individuals here in Louisiana, and part of that may be due in part to the same factors that are associated with cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes, hypertension. These sorts of things are
those
also
are contributors.
They're both in the risk factors. They're known established risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, and it's appearing that they play an important role in the how that Alzheimer's disease evolves in an individual.
So exercise can perhaps thwart the onset of Alzheimer's?
Correct. It can, just like with cardiovascular disease. And what's even more exciting, some of our research is showing, one of the big things we specialize in is looking at how much physical activity and inactivity people have and how that relates to cognitive decline and dementia. And what we're finding is that specific amounts of activity, so for example, 500 steps a day at moderate to vigorous physical activity is associated with individuals who have a cognitive impairment as compared to their age-match control individuals. And what this really means, Jim, is that instead of telling people to exercise for 30 minutes a day or 60 minutes of a certain type of activity, we can actually start to hone in on a prescribed amount, if you will, mm-hmm. or really target the type of physical activity that is most important.
Is aerobic exercise the best, or does it really matter?
Well, we're not to that stage yet, and that's really why our work is so important and why we need people in our studies. There's growing evidence that turns out it may be how much you move and the specific quality of those movements. Mm-hmm. We study quality, quantity, and patterns of movement. And it turns out how far you move from your bed every day and how often you leave your home, very, very important in your morbidity, mortality with Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. And also the steps, like I was mentioning, at moderate to vigorous physical activity. So we're kind of moving from talking about sort of aerobic or certain amount of time in the gym, strength training. Not that those things aren't important, but we're trying to really hone in on the most important aspects, because telling someone to exercise mm-hmm. is a difficult process.
297-5633 is your number for Dr. Jeffrey Keller of the Institute for Dementia Research and Prevention at Pennington Biomedical Research Center. Alex in Gonzales asks about diet. Does that have an impact on Alzheimer's?
Absolutely. So diet, physical activity, obesity, all of these factors are very important risk factors for dementia and can play a role in increasing as well as decreasing risk for dementia. And that's one of the big reasons we moved from the Alzheimer's Center at the University of Kentucky to here at Pennington, is to fit that those things are emerging as the most important factors that we can modify. And, of course, Pennington Biomedical does those like no other place in the country. And so we moved here 5 years ago to start working on diet and physical activity, obesity. And what we found is, and others around the country find is that deficiencies in diet, things like folate, vitamin E, carnitine, these deficiencies are associated strongly with the development of dementia. And so having diets that replenish these or enrich for these, as well as omega-3 nutrients, right? Yeah. So whenever people are deficient, diets can play a really obvious major role in decreasing risk and improving health, brain health. But it also may be in the absence of deficiencies that these things play a role. And that science is a little less established, but is a really active area of research at Pennington as well as around the country.
I've read that coffee is actually considered to be a possible help to thwarting Alzheimer's. At least I hope it is. Maybe that's wishful thinking.
Well, I'm not going to say anything bad about coffee, because I myself am a big partaker of coffee. But I would say that, these issues of, certain foods, food groups, or certain supplements, or different aspects of our diet, it's really only now being intensely investigated. It turned out a lot of the work that was done was neurologists and a pathologist doing really sort of not cutting-edge nutrition work in the area of Alzheimer's disease and these food associations. And now it's the tables turned. We're starting to see a lot of people that are focused in nutrition or at centers like Pennington starting to work on dementia.
Okay, 297-5633. We've got some folks waiting in line to talk to Dr. Jeffrey Keller. Before we go to the phone lines, what is the rate right now for Alzheimer's as far as people getting this dread disease?
So right now it's 5 million people at least in the United States. And in Louisiana, it's at least 90,000 people. And these people in Louisiana have generally 2 to 3 care providers. So what we're talking about is 300,000 people, Jim, right now, 1 in 15 in Louisiana that are directly affected by this disease. The Journal of the American Medical Association came out last month and said that Alzheimer's disease is a disease that costs us as much as cardiovascular disease, cancer. And these numbers are going to increase. 2040, we're looking at having 2.5 times more people with Alzheimer's disease.
Does it generally hit men more than women?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's the biggest risk factor is age, of course, and men don't typically live as long. And so you do have it's sort of an anomaly, but you do have more women with the disease, but it's largely associated with them living longer.
More women have it. Yeah. And the most prominent age for the onset?
1 in 7 over the age of 65 have the disease, and then, of course, it gets into 1 in 2 over 85. But those numbers are also based on a study that was done in a affluent, white, predominantly white suburb of Chicago, and they simply just take those numbers and apply them to the age demographics of a state. We know that states like Louisiana are going to be much higher.
Okay, please be brief for Dr. Jeffrey Keller for Pennington Biomedical Research, and he is on the forefront of dementia research in this country. We start with Henry in Glen Oaks. Good morning, Henry.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine.
Yes, my mom has dementia, and she had failed. Do it called like balance, where they lose their balance and stuff?
What about loss of balance? Is that a sign?
So when we talk about Alzheimer's disease, it's important to consider what happens early in disease and what happens later in the disease. And so those things that I was mentioning about how we tell Alzheimer's from other types of dementia, they're referring to what happens early in the early initial diagnosis. And what can happen later is just about anything. The one thing we know about Alzheimer's disease is it's different in everyone who has it. We really don't understand why there are so many different outcomes for people once they start to develop the disease. But they can certainly, you know, the loss of independence that happens for someone with Alzheimer's disease is caused by caregiver stress, loss of medication adherence, and falls. And these are all areas that we're starting to work on.
Daryl in Onsegan. Good morning, Daryl. And you're on with Dr. Jeffrey Keller.
Hi, thank you. My mom has Alzheimer's, and she was diagnosed when she was 75. My grandmother, too, had Alzheimer's, and she was diagnosed at 85. I'm scared that as I'm 60 right now, am I going to get it when I'm 65?
You're not alone. There are a lot of people out there who are worried and about their cognitive their risk for dementia and whether or not they're experiencing significant cognitive impairment. What I can tell you is we have free studies at the Pennington right now as part of my institute, the IDRP, and these studies are available to anyone over the age of 60. It provides free dementia screening as well as a fall risk assessment. You can, I think Jim's going to give some information on how you can contact us. You can go to the Pennington Biomedical website, and you can see under their research centers, and you can see the Institute for Dementia Research and Prevention and all the information on our trials as well as our free studies are on there. What we need to do is to get anyone that's interested in getting these assessments to get a baseline. You know, just like people go in to get you get your prostate exam or your mammograms, you get those things done as part of a baseline assessment. We provide a similar sort of thing for your cognition, so we can tell if you've had a change in cognition, and then if you have, set you up for a future trial.
297-5633 is your number for Dr. Jeffrey Keller. We'll hear from Johnny Palazzotto in the not-too-distant future as well. If you'd like information about what's going on at Pennington, you can call 877-276-8306. 877-276-8306. We'll be back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing A Bit More Time with Dr. Jeffrey Keller at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center. We're talking about Alzheimer's. That's his line of work. He was at the University of Kentucky, where he received his PhD and moved to Pennington 5 years ago, and is at the forefront of research all over this country regarding dementia and Alzheimer's. The United States, do we have a higher rate than the rest of the world?
That doesn't appear to be the case, but like I was alluding to earlier, there are certainly problems with the way we calculate it. It's largely just based on applying what was measured in one place for incidence, and that was an affluent Chicago suburb. And we know that places like Louisiana, where there are all of those cardiovascular disease risk factors, you know, Louisiana is the belt mm-hmm. buckle for about every bad belt there is with regards to health. And here in Louisiana, based on our studies, we see evidence for increased incidence as well as faster rates of progression.
Herb in Pollard Estates. Good morning, Herb. You're on with Dr. Keller.
Morning. Thank you. In looking at the medical literature, I've seen a couple articles that suggest that ibuprofen is a preventive but not treatment at times. I don't know how strong it is, not real strong, but at least there's a couple articles that say that it is helpful to prevent Alzheimer's. I'd be interested in the doctor's view of that, those articles.
Okay. Well, you can certainly have more time to inquire about these by coming in and participating in our studies. That's one of the things that we go over. But the with regards to aspirin, ibuprofen, NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, all of those things, it's a mixed bag. Some studies say they are associated with lower incidence, and some studies say that they're not associated with lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease. And part of that is because of the way studies were done in the past, and we really didn't have a good way of measuring Alzheimer's disease and early onset Alzheimer's disease. And there weren't enough of the random clinical trials to test their exact role. So association studies were not really that informative, and we don't have that clinical trial on those topics to make a definitive statement. So the jury's still out. We need more research.
Well, we've had, unfortunately, a rash of former professional football players who have this affliction early in life, I might add. And it's almost certainly reflective of concussions they receive. But what about people like probably you and me who played football as kids and got our bell rung, or maybe engaged in a few recreational fights and got our bell rung? Do we face the risk of Alzheimer's at a later age as a result of that?
The literature on that is pretty strong, and it's affirmative.
Yes.
There's an affirmative yes. Concussion, it's loss of consciousness for more than 5 minutes. And the number of those that an individual has ultimately does contribute to risk. You know, the biggest risk factors are age, family history, the presence of this thing called APOE4. These are things that are not modifiable. Things that are modifiable, things like diet, lifestyle, physical activity, in many instances, concussions. Those things are modifiable life choices, and that's an area that we really concentrate on at Pennington. The work that we're doing in the Dementia Institute fits in line with that mission at the Pennington to improve health throughout the lifespan. And those are areas that, by participating in our studies, you can learn more about, and certainly encourage everybody mm-hmm. to do what they can to prevent dementia.
And some of us have lost consciousness for several days as a result of accidents. So that's not a good thing, is it?
No, but, you know, that's an important thing to consider about risk. Increased risk does not mean, you know, anytime we look at associations and risk, it doesn't tell us what's going to happen to that particular individual. But we can certainly say, by looking at hundreds of thousands of people, that is associated with increased risk. But it doesn't tell us mm-hmm. what's going to happen with that person. evidence of cognitive impairment at an early anyone over the age of 50. That too is something that is very important to get a baseline measure on and keep a keep tabs on, because that early change from normal age cognition to a mild cognitive impairment, that is associated with dramatically increased risk for dementia, and you can be more aggressive with trying to intervene.
Okay, when you say normal cognitive impairment that comes with age, those are those senior moments we're talking about.
Correct.
That's a totally different thing, isn't it?
Correct. So when we hear people say, you know, in Kentucky, I was lucky enough to work with a bunch of centenarians, people that live to be 100 years of age and older, and about half of those individuals were dementia free. And but that doesn't mean that we had people in Kentucky that were 100 years old who had the brain power of a 20-year-old. You know, they had impairment, but it's what would be expected for age, and it was something that didn't cause them a loss of ability to function socially. And there is a big difference. And, you know, one of the big things are if you notice that you're having a cognitive change, that's a good sign. Because if you're aware that you've had some deterioration, that's good. What's not good is whenever you've had significant impairment and aren't aware of it. And that's starting to, then you're heading down that dementia road.
Charles on North Foster. Hi, Charles. You're on with Dr. Keller.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. Dr. Keller, from a chemical perspective, can you talk about improving brain plasticity and the potential stem cell treatment for Alzheimer's and dementia? I'll hang up and listen.
So what I can tell you is that we, like others around the country, are trying to improve that plasticity, and that is a very important thing. You know, your brain adapts over time, and how well it does adapt over time is, we believe, important for Alzheimer's disease. That's what one of the things that makes it quite hard. It's not one thing. It's this whole process that appears to go wrong in the development of the disease. And fixing a process is much more daunting than fixing a particular target, if you will, a particular enzyme. And so what I can tell you is that things like physical activity and other types of interventions, cognitive remediation, things that we're looking at, as well as the new drugs that are out there that we're testing and others around the country are testing, you know, they're not working on one pathway. They're working to affect multiple things, including improving plasticity. And so it's a very good point you brought up.
Once again, the number to find out more and to perhaps participate in one of these clinical trials, 877-276-8306. That's 877-276-8306. You may also go online at dementia@pbrc.edu. You've got 2,000 individuals, right, that you're looking at.
Correct. Those are people that are in our longitudinal studies. We're one of the 10 largest studies in the country. It's a free study again. These people come back. It's in its fourth year. People keep coming back year after year. They find benefit in it. And the idea is these are people that are non-demented individuals, but we're helping to keep that baseline measure in their fall risk and look at a variety of factors that cause people to remain stable or decline. We also have in the pipeline right now, we have existing trials for people once they have an impairment, but we want to have a lot more. And as I was alluding to earlier, Jim, one of the areas that we want to get to in the future is for those people with the disease to keep them living independently as long as possible and to work with local partners like Alzheimer's Services of the Capital Area, universities around the state, ULM Pharmacy School, LSU, Alexandria School of Allied Health. We want to do this in a very comprehensive way and to reduce caregiver stress, improve medication adherence, and reduce falls in people with dementia.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Keller. And once again, to reach Dr. Keller and his staff at Pennington, 877-276-8306. We look forward to an update.
Thank you very much.
Always good to see folks from Pennington Biomedical Research Center, and we're glad Dr. Keller is at the forefront of a major issue in this state and around the world, for that matter. And
well,
now,
I'm a cane bean, buzzing around your eye. Well, I'm a cane bean, buzzing around your eye. Well, I can make honey, baby, let me come inside.
That's the incomparable Slim Harpo, and this is that time of the year. for the Slim Harpo Music Awards, one of a few things we'll discuss with our guest now in studio, Johnny Palazzotto. Good morning to you, John.
Hey, Jim.
Well, Slim Harpo Awards, that's something that your baby, one of your babies, you've got a few children, including the Blues Fest, which went very well.
It did.
Well, what about Slim Harpo Awards coming next week?
Well, we were listening to I'm a King Bee, which was first recorded by Slim back in the late 50s, but also covered by the Rolling Stones on their first album. And the Slim Harpo Awards happened this Wednesday, May the 1st, and we're going to be recognizing three musicians from Southwest Louisiana that participated in the early recordings at J.D. Miller's studio in Crowley, Louisiana. Warren Storm, Guitar Gable, and Jockey Etienne. They all played on various sessions. Slim's songs were recorded by the Kinks, the Stones, Van Morrison, Hank Williams Sr., Neil Young recorded Raining in My Heart. So he's a significant Louisiana legend.
Slim's given name was James Moore. Yep. If he had been James Moore, he might not have achieved the acclaim he did.
Well, his songs are definitely noted throughout rock and roll history.
Well, your friend and mine, John Fred, noted that when he met the Beatles, they didn't give him the time of the of day until he told him he knew Slim Harpo, and then boom.
John had some really good stories about Slim. Actually, one of them, he was in line at the bank, and Slim came in with his first royalty check from the Stones on I'm a King Bee, and he asked John who the Rolling Stones were.
Well, in addition to the honorees next Wednesday, you've got several people in the musical world who will be there, some big names as well who are part of this event.
Deacon John Moore, Luther Kent, Kenny Acosta is hosting the jam, and also Miss Carol Fran, who just received the National Endowment for the Arts Award.
You've got Kenny Neal, John Lisi.
John Lisi.
And by the way, that new blues place, new as in it's
the
reopened. It was where Tabby had his last sojourn on stage. But John Lisi's there every Saturday night. I would imagine you've been there a few times.
John's one of our former ambassadors. And so, yeah, he's a great artist, a hardworking guy.
Well, you being the music aficionado you are, and you lived in Los Angeles for almost 20 years, right?
14 years.
Okay.
14 years.
You came back home, and you've made it your mission to preserve the rich musical legacy, in particular the blues in this area. We are really a cradle for the blues.
Yes, very much so. Baton Rouge is definitely a wealth of blues legacy. I coined a phrase a few years back. In the middle of the most musical 125 miles on earth, and if you look at the I-10 corridor between Lafayette and New Orleans, Baton Rouge sits in the middle. No place else on earth is the origins of jazz and rock and roll like New Orleans. Baton Rouge has more blues artists and legacy in the blues than does New Orleans, and Lafayette is the only place that has Cajun and Zydeco. So if you look at that 125 miles, it's a significant musical legacy for the United States and for the world.
And you've also embarked on something, Louisiana's Rhythm Nation, a documentary-style television show. What's this all about?
I'm very proud of that. as a matter of fact, Jim, you contributed to that when we did the interview with Tony Joe White. In fact, that will be one of episodes that's coming up. We videotaped his performance at the Varsity Theater. You did the interview on this show, and that'll be one of the shows down the line here. And that show is teamed up with Bonnie Bramlett. It's going to be a fascinating show.
42 years in the music business for Johnny Palazzotto, who's rubbed shoulders with all the greats, and some he knows intimately, like Tony Joe White, who he's known for Polk Salad Annie, but the songs he's written. He wrote Rainy Night in Georgia.
Yes.
I think that's one of the 10 great songs of all time.
And he told us that story in that interview of how he wrote that song. If you'll remember, he was driving a dump truck in Georgia, and it was raining. And so when it rained, they didn't shovel gravel and sand.
You know, the other night in Lafayette, I saw Boz Skaggs, and he did Rainy Night in Georgia.
I wanted to go to that show.
He did it well. He didn't do it quite as well as Brooke Benton, but he was, you know, on a scale of 1 to 100, with Brooke being 100, he was about 98. He was good.
Boz is one of my favorites. I worked with him briefly in Los Angeles.
I followed him through the years, and most people don't know that his grade school classmate was Steve Miller.
Yes.
In Dallas.
He was in the original Steve Miller band.
Yeah, and then the guy at Rolling Stone discovered him, Jan Winter, and Silk Degrees came shortly thereafter and made Boz a very rich man. But he's 69, or he will be in June, and he has like a 100-city concert tour going on now. How do these people do this after all these years? You would think that Johnny Rivers being somewhat similar. They just keep doing it year after year, and it doesn't seem to matter what the calendar says.
Love of the music, enthusiasm, and discipline really has a lot to do with it. And also having a great staff to work with. You have to have people that are taking care of your responsibilities, getting from place to place and coordinating and arranging for your band and everything that goes on with it.
Well, Powell Productions, Johnny's company, will also present Duke and the King, a documentary in the Manship Theater on May 2nd. That's next Thursday, a night after the Slim Harpo Awards, 7 o'clock. Tell us about Duke and the King.
Well, I think we're going to have Duke on the phone here in a second, but Duke moved to Los Angeles just about the same time I did and was Elvis Presley's bass player for a couple of years. And it's a very interesting documentary and concert footage from Duke. He's a Baton Rougean. He was in the Greek Fountains. He was in Cold Grits and the Black Eyed Peas. He played with Jose Feliciano, Gene Clark, and Emmylou Harris.
And in 1974 and 1975, and this was when Elvis was actually doing some of his best work, but, of course, he was a couple of years away from the end. The bassist was this man, Duke Bardwell, who is calling in, and this is a pleasant surprise. Good morning to you, Duke.
Well, hey, Jim.
Good to hear your voice again, and you'll be on stage in 6 nights. Kind of.
Yeah, it does. It seems like right around the corner, things are moving pretty quick right now. We're leaving the 7th to go back on another one of our few weeks tours over in Europe, celebrating the man and his music again.
Well, so, Duke Bardwell knew Elvis Presley well, and you knew him when he was going downhill physically. But my favorite period as far as his music was when you were playing with him. He did some great work in the last few years of his life.
Well, he really did. He had been off for 6 months by the time I got with him, and he had been getting in good condition and losing weight. I mean, he came out of the chutes running in 74, and that was, I think, to date, still one of his busiest touring years. So I got to be there for a lot of his real strength and power, but unfortunately had to watch him decline at the same time. And
all right, hold on. We'll resume with Duke Bardwell and Johnny Palazzotto, and we'll discuss next week. Big week for Johnny and company. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. In a few moments, we'll hear from Marcus Cox. His book is Segregated Soldiers, Military Training at Historically Black Colleges in the Jim Crow South. And, of course, that would include our own Southern University. But we resume with Johnny Palazzotto, who's a music producer, man who's been in the business for more than four decades, and his buddy Duke Bardwell, who's one of the fine musicians produced by this town, the bassist for Elvis Presley in 1974 and 1975, and come next Thursday at the Manship Theater, 7 o'clock, there will be a documentary, Duke and the King, following the journey of Baton Rouge legend Duke Bardwell and his stint in playing in Elvis Presley's band. And Duke, Elvis was, he was a guy who was, I guess, tough and talented, but what kind of a fellow was he as far as working with? Was he a jerk or was he a nice guy?
No, he actually was a very nice person. I was fortunate enough to be able to spend some time outside of the realm of the Memphis Mafia, as it was, with him. And he was exactly who I thought he was and who I had hoped he would be, because I had become a big fan of his at a very early age. So, but when the music started happening and the rehearsals and everything else like that, he knew exactly what he wanted. He did not know music. He didn't read music. It was straight off the cuff. But, I mean, he knew what he wanted to hear, and he knew if you didn't play it right. So, yeah, it was a good bit of pressure, but, my Lord, it was a lot of fun.
I bet it was. Now, Johnny Palazzotto, that's something that you're intricately involved with as far as the documentary Duke and the King. But I did want to note once again that Wednesday, the Slim Harpo Awards, for those who'd like more information, best way to find you or the people who are involved.
Well, you can go to themanshiptheater.org or call the box office at 344-0334 for tickets for both Duke and the King and the Slim Harpo Awards. Slim Harpo is Wednesday and Duke and the King is Thursday.
And Johnny's number, in case you want to talk with him.
Yes, 383-0968. Also, Louisiana's Rhythm Nation will be on again today on Cox 4 at 12 o'clock.
That's 12?
Noon.
Noon. All right. Well, thank you, Johnny Palazzotto. And did want to note before we leave the passing this week of Richie Havens.
Gosh.
August 15th, 1969. He opened Woodstock with this, Done on the Fly. Where were you that day?
I was in Miami.
Duke, where were you?
I was in New York with Tom Rush.
All right. Well, this is a day that will live forever in music history.
Richie Hitt, the truth.
Who I guess was 28 years old, and he was first because other acts were unable to get through the traffic. He ended up playing for over an hour, some say close to two. Richie said 2 hours and 45 minutes. And the most memorable concert of all time.
Well, man, it was good talking to you guys, and I hope to see everybody. We started at 7 o'clock, and I'm going to be doing some new songs I've written and some.
Okay. Thank you.
See you, Dugan.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thanks, Johnny.
Now we're joined by Marcus Cox. His book is Segregated Soldiers, Military Training at Historically Black Colleges in the Jim Crow South. Dr. Cox specializes in 20th century African-American history, earned his B.S. degree from Southern University, as well as his M.A. in history, and has a Ph.D. from Northwestern University. Good morning, Dr. Cox.
Yes, sir. Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing well, and this is a legacy that is often overlooked as far as military training at black colleges in the Jim Crow South. And if we look at the U.S. military today, there are a disproportionate number of African Americans who are serving our country in war zones compared to the general population. And you say this is not a new phenomenon, that particularly these historically black colleges have had a major impact on the U.S. armed forces.
Yeah, that's correct. And even though African Americans are represented disproportionately in the sort of the ranks, but in terms of the leadership positions in the officer corps, that number has fluctuated. But obviously, has always been lower than their representation in the population. And that's part of the reason why, obviously, these historically black colleges embraced military training programs. But it goes well beyond that in terms of those programs and its value and contributions to not only the black community, but also the U.S. military.
You note that in the 1960s, when we were amid the Vietnam War and civil rights unrest in the United States, obviously unpopular war, there was a rise in black nationalism and an expanding economy that offered many African Americans enhanced economic opportunities. But despite the challenges, in particular for people of color in this country, support for the military persisted among black people. Why so?
Well, I think historically, the military, when I say historically, I'd say over the last the decade or two before, since the 1940s, African Americans joined the military for a lot of different reasons. And many of those reasons did not include necessarily patriotism. It was an opportunity for African Americans to have steady job employment. It offered them educational opportunities. It offered them the opportunity to leave the South and see the world. And many soldiers and men and women left the South and pursued employment or opportunities in the military and then decided never to come back. So it had a very strong socializing and economic influence on African Americans. And so by the 1960s, when you have a lot of the civil rights movement is going on and there's a lot of political and unrest, you still have many African Americans who still see the value in serving in the military. And again, some of it is patriotism, but a lot of it is not necessarily patriotism, or that's not the driving force. So the programs were able to survive, and when a lot of the programs in the South, in addition to a lot of the white ROTC programs, started making ROTC training voluntary, then you see a drop in the number of students who are interested in military service, and that goes across the board. But you still also see a sort of a healthy contingent of African Americans who still want to pursue careers in the military.
297-5633, Dr. Marcus Cox, Associate Professor of History at the Citadel in South Carolina. So you're teaching at a military college right now. That must be an experience.
It is. It is. I've enjoyed every minute of it. Only about 35% of our students here at the Citadel go, pursue a military career. So the vast majority of them don't. But many of them come here for the discipline and for the military structure. And it's been a terrific honor and pleasure of mine to be here.
297-5633 to talk to this interesting gentleman, who has written a book published by LSU Press, Segregated Soldiers, Military Training at Historically Black Colleges in the Jim Crow South, Dr. Marcus Cox, who has 2 degrees from Southern. And you use Southern University as a case study. Southern's a fine place to study the role of blacks at these schools and their roles in the military.
Right, right. Southern University was, well, obviously I have a connection to Southern University and as well as my family, but Southern was a good sort of case study because it was probably one of the largest black colleges during the 1950s, and by the late 1960s, early 70s, the student enrollment went over 10,000, and so based on its size and its influence in the black community, it also had national implications. I also talk quite a bit about Tuskegee Institute in the book and using Southern as sort of a land-grant public institution and then looking at Tuskegee as a private institution and sort of kind of comparing them in a way and showing how many things that are happening at Southern University are not only happening at Tuskegee, but at South Carolina State University and Morgan State University and different HBCUs across the country. So by looking at Southern, you really get a really good sense of what's happening throughout the United States with these historically black colleges.
Donald in Monticello, you're on with Marcus Cox. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Cox. My name is Donald Smith. I want to thank you for your service to and commitment to education and military service. I'm from Baton Rouge. I grew up mostly in inner city schools, and my first school of application when I graduated was the United States Air Force Academy.
Okay.
And I pursued my recommendation from Senator Boggs, and I received it, and I actually got accepted, but I was talked out of it by family members because they felt that my maturity level at that time wasn't quite right for military. I wanted to be a pilot. So I eventually ended up going on to Louisiana Tech and not pursuing that military degree. And, of course, you know, to become a pilot, you have to have several thousand hours of turbine time. And I didn't get that, but I'm familiar with a lot.
Okay, thank you for sharing your story, Donald. Quelly in Scotlandville. Quelly, good morning.
Good morning. How are you? Yes, sir.
Good Fine. Morning.
Well, I have a question. I've seen documentaries where it has been noted that many African Americans that served in the military in the early part of the 20th century, more so in the Second World War, were overlooked for accommodations on the battlefield, meaning for acts of valor or things of that nature. What impact do you think that has on the African Americans that may look to go into the military, knowing that there has been a history of discrimination and segregation in the military?
That's a good question. Well, when you look at the experience that African Americans had with the U.S. military throughout sort of the Jim Crow era, many African Americans pursued military service for all the reasons I spoke of earlier, knowing that there was racism and discrimination in the military. But on the other hand, many African Americans believed that they had a better chance and more opportunity in the military than in civilian society. So, in other words, they were going to, in many cases, experience racism, discrimination in civilian society, and even though it would happen in the military, it was probably less likely to happen. So that's why it necessarily didn't deter African Americans from pursuing that career path. When you look at the military today, again, and I tell my students all the time, the military is literally it's a reflection of civilian society. In other words, what's going on in society is going to happen in the military. But the perception is that the military offers a sort of a fair and more equitable way of doing things, and that African Americans and minorities have better opportunities and chances in the military.
Rinaldi on I-10. Rinaldi, you're on the air with Dr. Marcus Cox.
Dr. Cox, thank you so much. I'm going to buy your book. I have a son who's going into the military, you know, to help pay for his career. He finished at Southern, and he's looking forward to a military career, and I'm going to get a copy of your book. Hopefully I can send it to you, get it autographed, and give it to
Absolutely.
My son.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
We're in the military, and one of my classmates, I think he's one of the few black generals in the Marines. Who's just become a brigadier general. So thank you so much, Alumnus, for writing your book, and I'll buy as many copies as I can and give them out to people because it's a rich, rich history, Jim, of black generals from Southern University and other HBCUs. So thank you so much. I'll give it to hopefully a future general who's graduated.
There you go.
Well, sir, if you send me the books, I will definitely autograph it for you.
And that's Dr. Marcus S. Cox at Citadel. Now, November 16th, 1972, when we look at that day as a significant day in history, it not only included the end of the infamous Tuskegee syphilis experiment, but it also included a protest of 100 students at historically black Southern University, broken up with tear gas by 55 sheriff's deputies, 30 state troopers, two students, Leonard Brown being one of them, and the name of the other young man, Denver Smith. They were killed by a shotgun blast, apparently by one of the deputies, but the shooter was never identified. You go into some depth about this incident in your book.
Right. Yep. And it's really interesting. When I discuss this very, very important event in Southern University's history, first of all, it really reflects similar events and incidents that happened throughout the South. Southern is one institution. South Carolina State had a similar event. Texas Southern University had a similar event. And there's no real direct connection to military training or the military. In other words, the student leaders were not necessarily ROTC cadets. But what it really reflects is sort of a general mistrust for authority. And how young African Americans looked at what was happening around them as it related to the Vietnam War, as it related to government policies and inaction by the federal and state government on many issues, that it had an impact on individuals and their desire to go in the military. Because, one of the things that I discussed throughout the book is this, the contradiction of being a black soldier. In other words, you are fighting for the country, but yet you're treated as a second-class citizen. Now, again, African Americans at that particular time and throughout history were treated as second-class citizens. But when you served in the military, there was an expectation that you would be treated with first-class citizenship. And so it's almost like a double slap in the face when you're serving in the military. So that event and many events like it had a tremendous impact on the level of interest and commitment that many African Americans had in the military.
Well, thank you, Dr. Marcus Cox. His book from LSU Press, Segregated Schools, appropriately the foreword by Lieutenant General Russell L. Honoré, Saluting Military Training at Historically Black Colleges. Do want to note an email from Colonel Henry Johnson saying that George Jones, a music legend, dead at 81. Colonel Johnson says he did show up at the Centralplex a few years ago and gave a memorable performance. So we'll miss George Jones. Until Monday, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.